It's Lars. Thank you for checking out my podcast, and have a great day.
Happy First Amendment Friday, and welcome to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Today, live from the Tri-Cities in Eastern Washington with News Radio 610 KONA at the Moore Mansion. And believe me, the owners of this wonderful old historic house, 110 years old this year, 110 years of history right here. It ties into Seattle. It ties into other parts of the Northwest. It ties into Washington State's original shipment of apples as an export crop, which is now a major export crop from the state of Washington. This house is so beautiful, and my wife is so envious because she couldn't make the trip. She had jury duty. But she couldn't make the trip. But the fact is, she loves houses like this. An old house where the owners have decided, let's bring it back to its former glory. This thing dates all the way back to 1908, built for $20,000 by the same guy who built the Moore Theater in Seattle, the longest continuously operating theater in the state, and then came out here to Pasco when the town wasn't even nearby. It was a couple of miles down a dirt path, and built this amazing house, which is now an event center. It's a private home as well. Weddings are hosted here. It's absolutely beautiful and a perfect place for First Amendment Friday. Welcome to the program and welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. We have a lot to talk about today. There's a lot of anger out there about the fact that President Trump had threatened to veto this $1.3 trillion spending bill, but then at the end of the day, he signed the bill. He also said, I'll never sign another one like this, but for an awful lot of voters, and I'm already hearing from them by email, social media, and such, they're saying, well, the fact that you did it once makes us not believe necessarily that you're not going to do it again. So there is that on the agenda as well. Our Twitter poll today, you can find it at Lars Larson Show on Twitter and also LarsLarson.com, the website. Should police release the names of students caught bringing weapons to school? And let me take just tell you about this. Because, of course, there has been concern about violence and especially mass violence at American public schools. Intense concern for at least the last quarter of a century, dating back to Thurston High School in Springfield, dating back to Columbine in Littleton, Colorado, and, of course, dating back about 6 weeks ago to the terrible murders that happened in Parkland, Florida. So you'd think the community and those who serve it in politics, in district attorney's offices, and in the police force would appreciate the community's concern. Let me tell you why I do not think they appreciate your concern. There was, just after the Parkland shooting, there was an incident where a teenage kid, 17 years old, just on the cusp of becoming an adult, decided to bring a pistol. This is after the Parkland shooting. Decided to bring a pistol to school in Oregon. Now, he took a picture of himself with the pistol tucked in his waistband, and then he posted on social media. He didn't even try to make it a secret. I understand there are people who secretly bring weapons to school, to other places where they shouldn't be, and at 17, he has no business being in possession of any kind of firearm. But he did it. He took a picture. He posted on social media. When that became public, the police found out who he was, realized that the picture showed him carrying the gun at school, which is a crime, possessing it at 17, another crime, a whole stack of crimes. They arrested him. And then I asked for his name. I asked the police for his name. I asked the Multnomah County Juvenile Court for his name. And the way I read the laws, I have the right to get his name. But more importantly, the community has the right to his name. Do you know what the police said? We can't release it. The law doesn't let us. Do you know what the juvenile court said? We're not going to release it. We will not tell the community who this young man was. And if you say, well, Lars, why do you need to know? Do you want somebody to go get even with him? No, I don't want that at all. But I want the community to be able to identify current threats to public safety. I'd say my case, this is the argument I'd make. If you're a 17-year-old and you think it's funny, you bring a gun to school, you take a picture, you post it on social media, you say, hey, look, everyone, I brought a pistol to school a week after the Parkland shooting. I think that's a dangerous kid. He's got some dangerous ideas. He's got, more importantly, when it comes to crime, he's got some dangerous behavior. The community should know who he is. And yet, we're being told by the folks who safeguard the community, the courts, the prosecutor, and the police, you cannot have that information. I got the refusal, the formal refusal, because I filed a formal public records request. I know the law well. I've been using it for the better part of 30 years. I know how to work that law. I know what the law says the public is entitled to see. And this isn't just some special law for reporters and talk show hosts and people like that. This is a law for everyone. It's for you. There's a public records law in Oregon. There's one in Washington State. There's one in most states. This is not the federal FOIA. It's a state law that says to be able to be a good citizen and have the community and government work well, the public has to know what's going on. You don't. You don't know who this kid is. And I'm willing to bet every kid in that school knows who that kid is. I'm willing to bet every teacher in that school knows who that kid is. Every government employee knows who that kid is, but you don't know who that kid is. And the government that says it's safeguarding you says you don't have the right to know who he is. Now, they gave no reason other than to say it's an ongoing investigation. Well, not being a cop or a lawyer or an investigator, let me just suggest to you, how much investigation do you need to determine that a crime has been committed when a kid takes a picture of himself carrying a gun at school and it shows that he's at school, it shows the gun, it shows him, the police have arrested and charged him? How much more investigation do you need? I think they're holding the name back because of restorative justice. I think this whole idea that, oh, a kid committed a crime that could have turned into some violence, he could have pulled the gun out and used it. He was breaking the law just by having it, and by having it at school especially. But we don't want to embarrass him. We don't want the community to know who he is. We don't want him to suffer if he applies for a job. Maybe he should be babysitting your kids. Imagine that. Imagine if this kid is working somewhere, but you don't know who he is. So my question today, Twitter poll, should police release the names of students caught bringing weapons to school? It's found on Twitter, at Lars Larson Show, brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for your business, keep your biggest assets on the road and running right online at ultimatetruckservice.com. It is First Amendment Friday. Your phone calls and your emails are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Follow me on Facebook, The Lars Larson Show, Twitter, at Lars Larson Show, and let's get First Amendment Friday started right from the Moore Mansion in Pasco with our local affiliate, KONA, with a little bit of Northwest nonsense.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense, presented by the Ryan Group, where they guarantee to sell your house in 29 days or less, or they'll buy it. 29andgone.com.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
Finding the right people to work for you challenges every single American president. When the media and your own party poison the waters, it's even harder. President Trump made some early picks that didn't fit, including H.R. McMaster in the critical spot of National Security Advisor. The general sat to the left politically of his boss, Donald Trump. So yesterday, the president decided to let him go and replace him with a pure gem. I've known Ambassador John Bolton for a decade. He doesn't pull punches. He's not afraid to say that if America's national security is threatened, say by a bad nuke weapons deal with Iran or the insanity of Kim Jong-un, we will act militarily if necessary. In fact, the biggest rap from the left wing that I listened to as I drove out to Eastern Washington last night for today's broadcast from the Tri-Cities, the worst thing they can say about Ambassador Bolton, he might encourage the president to strike if something puts our country in danger. Isn't that the president's job? We had 8 years of a president who ignored the threat of North Korea, gave away the store to the terror-sponsoring mad mullahs of Tehran. And now we have an unabashedly America First president and John Bolton to back him up. Well, I say, hoo-ah.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe you're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Dan Jones Conveyor Trucks. Rock, granite, topsoil, or sand. Let Dan Jones Conveyor Trucks put it where you want it.
Well, I'm going to award today's Daily Grill to a woman whose name you may or may not even recall, Amanda Marshall. She was the U.S. attorney for the state of Oregon, appointed by President Barack Hussein Obama. And if you got a job like that, wouldn't you safeguard it pretty well? She apparently decided that having an extramarital affair with one of her subordinates in the U.S. attorney's office was more interesting than hanging on to her job. Well, she's finally been sanctioned by the Supreme Court of Oregon, barred from practicing law for 90 days because she lied about a sexual relationship with a subordinate. Does that sound familiar? Maybe from the 1990s? When you lie to federal officials, that's actually a crime. Martha Stewart went to prison for that crime. General Michael Flynn was convicted of a felony for that kind of crime. But apparently Amanda Marshall, she's only going to miss out on 3 months of paychecks as a lawyer. I think the punishment should have been tougher. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Scott Abramson from Lake Oswego writes, and Lars, Zuckerberg is happy to have Facebook regulated. Of course, he's made his billions. He's happy to use regulations to keep conservatives off social media. A few years ago, Groupon prevented people from offering deals on firearm safety classes. I wrote a polite letter to them that I would cease using their service. Conservatives don't seem to think that competition in the free marketplace would work. If somebody opened up a competitor to Facebook without the constraints, all the conservatives would flock to it. And like Air America, Facebook could wither away. It is First Amendment Friday. We're live at the Moore Mansion in Pasco. It is a pleasure to be here as the guests of Brad and Deborah Peck in their 110-year-old home that has so much history tied up in it, not just for here in the Tri-Cities, but also in Seattle and other parts of Washington. I'm glad to get your calls at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com.
Everyone hates the IRS. Now, here's Lars with the latest outrage from the tax man.
Oh, believe it or not, Seattle wants to tax your groceries at the highest rate but exempt pot. The so-called Progressive Revenue Tax Force, set up by the City of Seattle City Council, has issued a recommendation for a payroll tax. But the payroll tax would be set up on businesses that sell you your food and clothing and drugs and everything else. And they want to do this, but they want to let the pot stores alone. So for some reason, buying food and buying clothing and the necessities of life is not nearly as important as buying groceries and all that and buying pot. This one doesn't make any sense, but they are literally proposing a progressive code, Seattle style, let them smoke pot. This is nuts. The proposed tax would be lower than Seattle's 10.1% sales tax. The task force proposal offers a variety of different thresholds for tax and various rates, but the main proposal, a tax of $400 per employee, would increase typical costs for a supermarket by about $50,000 a year. And if you think, as they point out, that doesn't sound like much. Well, here's the problem. Grocery stores run on a very thin margin, usually less than 2% profit. So if you had a $50,000 cost, count on them passing it along. And where are they going to pass it along? In your groceries and all the other necessities of life. By the way, do we have that soundbite of Donald Trump talking about why he signed the tax bill? If we don't have it right now, we can always get to it in a couple of minutes. But I wanted you to hear. Let's play it right here, if you don't mind.
Therefore, as a matter of national security, I've signed this omnibus budget bill. There are a lot of things that I'm unhappy about in this bill. There are a lot of things that we shouldn't have had in this bill, but we were, in a sense, forced, if we want to build our military, we were forced to have. There are some things that we should have in the bill. But I say to Congress, I will never sign another bill like this again. I'm not going to do it again.
Now, here's what Russ in Oregon City says. Lars, just thinking out loud here, I'm thinking that with his tough military talk, Trump would have signed anything as long as it contained more dollars to the military. I'll not vote for Trump again. Actually, I doubt he'll run again. He might not even get renominated. Looking forward to your show today. And this one from Larry, talking about a bad bill. Lars, I'm deeply disappointed Trump signed the bill to the point of being borderline angry. Some of the stuff in it is blatantly despicable. But then I got to thinking the big item of the bill that Trump wanted was military spending. Why? I'm thinking we may be worse off than we're allowed to know. Is he that desperate? But still, why not just veto and get the needed money in a revised bill? Well, let me tell you something, Larry. I'd love to see a revised bill, and I'm willing to bet the president would too. Here's the problem. You have to get the votes to pass it. The congressman for this district, Dan Newhouse, he voted against this bill. I think that there are members of Congress who said this is too much. But if you say, well, we'll just get another bill that'll make the Democrats happy enough to vote for it, well, good luck with that, because the Democrats aren't voting for much of anything these days. Let's go to Mike, who's listening in the Tri-Cities on KONA. Hey, Mike, welcome to the Lars Larson Show on First Amendment Friday.
Well, thank you, Lars. I'm a good fan of you guys from Oregon. And my question is, I want to get to the point, is I think that the United States, they should ban our kids in schools. And I don't know how people are stealing guns to kill people. They need to have, our law enforcement needs to have each cop or our law enforcement at a lot of these schools to protect the kids and people, so they know that, you know, they'll live, you know, live a long time, but.
It's not a bad idea, Mike, but here's the problem. We have cops in many schools, and the cops are being told, don't arrest the kids. And you know who's making that decision? The local school boards are saying, we don't want kids arrested at our school. It makes the schools look bad. So literally, they have this thing called restorative justice, where the schools are telling the cops, don't arrest the kids. Let's go to Dylan in Battleground. Hey, Dylan, welcome to First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind, sir?
Yeah, I was calling because I'm just, if you excuse me if I'm a little upset. I live in Battleground in a rural area. There's a bad intersection there. Gets a lot of use from the quarry trucks. The county came, patched the hole several times. They keep opening up as potholes do. Then they came and did the whole intersection, which, you know, that's awesome. Fix it once the right way. Except the holes that they repaired opened back up. And then they came back a week later, dug that area out again, repaved it. Did a really crappy job. Then they come back a couple days ago, dig the area out again and redo it. I mean, what, it's like third time's the charm. How much money is being wasted every time they do that intersection? It's ridiculous.
That's very well put, Dylan, and I appreciate the phone call. It is First Amendment Friday. He's right. Oftentimes, government does the job over and over and over again. Would you get away with that in the private sector? I don't think I would. We're live at the Moore Mansion, courtesy of the Peck family. And I'm glad to be with you on a First Amendment Friday from the Tri-Cities and KONA. And glad to be with you here on the Radio Northwest Network. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. We're live from the Moore Mansion in Eastern Washington in the city of Pasco with our friends from KONA, one of our great Radio Northwest affiliates. And I'm glad to be here doing First Amendment Friday Live. And on the phone with me right now is Senator Sherrod Brown. Senator Brown, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be in your neck of the woods.
Oh, it's so great to have you here, Lars. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Pasco is very welcoming, and the Moore Mansion's a great place to do a show. I said that this is the nicest house I've done a broadcast from since the White House a few months ago, and this is the nicest private house, because the White House is not a private house, so it's especially great to be here. Before we get to some of the issues at the state level, I want to know from you, what do you think of the president's action today in signing that $1.3 billion spending bill? Because there's a lot of anger out there about that right now.
I'm just going to say that we do things a lot differently here on a state level.
Well, it's good. That's a good thing, because I'm a Trump fan. I voted for him. I endorsed him. But I wish George Bush had used the veto pen more, and I said so, and I'm going to say that I wish this president would use the veto pen more. He deals tough with, you know, you can tell that he's a tough dealer when it comes to North Korea, Iran, or the Congress, and he's got some things done. But this is very frustrating to see a sign off on more spending on almost everything, even if the deal was presented as to get more military spending, you're going to need to spend more on all these other things, including some things that are really not good at all.
Yeah, you know, some things just aren't worth buying.
Yeah, they're not. They're absolutely not. And I could think of a lot of things that could be cut from the federal government before we cut into meat and bone. So tell me about your district, and tell me about what you're planning to do the next time you're in Olympia, and how are things going there in Olympia for people in the minority party?
Oh, it has been an awful year. It's been a year where process and policy has been circumvented time and time again. We've seen end-arounds around the Constitution. It was just really made me sick to my stomach to have to watch the show, because we were unable to stop any of these gimmicks that they were doing. Particularly, I want to talk about the felony gimmick to get around the Constitution and irresponsibly raid the rainy day fund. That was absolutely inexcusable. I was there at the meeting when we were told that we had all this additional revenue from the Revenue Forecast Council. John Braun, who is our representative on that council, was doing his military duty and had asked me to step in for him. So it was a great honor to be there. And I was very ecstatic when we had those funds. But as you're well aware, our Constitution requires that when we have extraordinary revenue, that it be dedicated to the budget stabilization account, a portion of it be dedicated to the budget stabilization account, the BSA, or as we usually refer to it, the rainy day fund. And so for the Democrats to just do an end around our Constitution, and be able to do a grab of this money was sickening to me, absolutely sickening. And I'm
Senator Braun, would you mind, could you tell us, I know this is in legislative talk, but can you, for a layperson like me, a Washington State resident who pays his taxes, what was the guarantee in the Constitution and how did the Democrats, because this is a partisan issue, how did the Democrats do an end around from a constitutional limitation on spending money?
It's baffling to me. So technically, the money was supposed to go into this rainy day fund. So what the Democrats did is they grabbed it as it came in so that it didn't actually have to fit into this certain bucket, which constitutionally would require it to go into the rainy day fund. So they basically redirected the funds, and it really circumvented the law. It absolutely circumvented the law, and it was just sickening to me. And then what is also really sickening to me is some of the things that they spent the money on, chose to spend the money on, but didn't spend it in other areas. For example, I had a bill that would help the sick Hanford workers. I helped Director Sachs a couple years ago establish a Center of Excellence for Sarcoidosis and Beryllium Disease over at Harborview Medical Center, and we've got great doctors there now that can attend to these sick folks. I was talking to Director Sachs, and we were trying to figure out a way to maybe expand that program to include some of these sick workers who have been exposed to the vapors out here. So we had an agreement and a great piece of legislation that we had worked on for almost a year. It sailed through the Senate. Not one person had a problem with it. Sailed through the policy committees in the House, landed in the House Appropriations Committee, and they said it was too expensive. I'm going to tell you, it was like $230,000 a year to expand that center of excellence to include studies for these sick workers and try and get them the help that they need. And yet we are spending, I'm not going to say we, the Democrats chose to spend $1.2 million on protecting whales, killer whales. And I'm not going to say that protecting killer whales is not important, but I'm going to say I really believe that an individual's life is incredibly important. And if we can dedicate resources to finding the best doctors in the world to help these people, then that's what we ought to be doing with some of these resources. So I was
I might go at it stronger than you do, Senator Braun. I might say a human being's life is always more important than the life of an animal.
Absolutely.
And I'm with you. If we've got a few, if we got the extra dollars, protect wildlife, protect the orcas and everything else. But if it comes down to a human or a whale, I can tell you which one I'm going to choose. There's not any doubt in my mind.
Not any doubt in my mind either, Lars. I will choose the human all day long. And I say we have a moral responsibility because of the stuff we have out there at Hanford to take care of these workers. And so, you know, to have worked on a piece of policy that would actually help people, and UW doctors that I talked to were ecstatic about this because it would give Washington State an opportunity to be a leader in this area in vapor exposures. They were going to do a call to their counterparts around the world, doctors around the world, to see who else had experience in this area to get these people the care that they need. And something that's particularly unique about the situation, Lars, is that we have these tanks. We know the constituents in some of the tanks. We know that some of these workers are getting ill as a result of the exposure, but we don't know how the exposure is going to move throughout these workers' bodies. So what's particularly disconcerting to me is that they're being seen by medical professionals who will say, and probably rightly so, okay, you look good now, But what's going to happen in 5 or 10 years from now, Lars? And that was an impetus for starting this program. So we had a base of operations so UW doctors could monitor these people who have been exposed and establish a baseline. And from there, begin to work with them, and so they would be right on top of the latest treatment plans and the latest technology to get these people the help they need. But no, that didn't happen because the Democrats took that money in. Doggone it, this state is going to save whales, not people.
Do you think there's a possibility? Because I think sometimes Republicans, I'll say that we're guilty of not being very good at marketing. We hide, as they you say, hide our light under a bushel basket. And I've never understood why we're not good at then turning around at election time and saying, by the way, whales are people. Which do you choose? The Democrats chose made this choice, put it right in their lap.
I am all over it. Let me tell you, absolutely. They need to own this because, you know, how many lives are going to be lost until I can bring the legislation back again and work it through the system again? It's absolutely appalling to me that they would choose a whale over a person.
Senator Brown, it's a pleasure to be in your district, and thank you very much for coming on the program.
Oh, you bet, Lars. And if there's any other follow-up information you need, I'm always available. And thank you so much for making the trip over. Really appreciate it, and enjoy our fine little corner of the world.
The hospitality here has been fantastic, and I'm really glad to be here. Senator Brown, thank you very much. We're live at the Moore Mansion today for First Amendment Friday on the road because I like to take the show on the road every chance I get and get out of that studio. We're here at the Moore Mansion, built in 1908. Mr. Moore was the man behind the Moore Theater in Seattle. He was a big apple grower here in Pasco, and he left behind a wonderful mansion and is now being put back into its proper state by the folks who own it now, the Pecks. And I'm their guest as well in their living room, doing the radio show from their living room. It's First Amendment Friday. Your calls are welcome at 866-439-5277. And you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. We have a big region we cover with the Radio Northwest Network, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and the Tri-Cities, which includes Pasco. And that's where I am today at the Moore Mansion. And this is a beautiful house. I'm going to put some pictures up on both Facebook and the website, and I'll send them back to the guys. I want to mention something to you, though. We've talked about PERS so many times. The public employee retirement system, the system that is anywhere, depending on what kind of magic math you apply to it, it is either $25 billion in the red or it's $50 billion in the red. It is broke. Guess what we just found out today? An updated pension set of data has been released. Joe Robertson, who was president of Oregon Health and Science University, he's been working for 33 years. His pension will be $76,111. And if you say, well, that doesn't seem like a really big pension, I forgot to mention, $76,111.28 per month. His total annual take from the public employee retirement system that is functionally bankrupt will be $913,335 per year from a system that is either $25 billion in the red or $50 billion in the red. Now, what do you think about that? Let's go to Bob in Sandy. Hey, Bob, welcome to First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind? Hello, Bob. Bob's not there. We're going to have to drop Bob. Let's go to naysayer Jay in Fairview. Jay, we love naysayers. What do you and I disagree about?
Well, I listened to your broadcast last week, Mr. Larson. And
thank you.
Especially regarding the homeless.
Okay. And?
Where we seem to have a fundamental disagreement on, and I just first want a clarification because I've never heard anybody refer to them as parasites before. Is this because of the...
Actually, I don't recall referring... I've referred to them as concrete campers. I've referred to them as squatters when they occupy somebody else's land. I don't recall saying parasites, but let's say we did. If somebody is able-bodied and sound of mind, they should be working. There are an awful lot of people who are camping on the concrete who are able-bodied and sound of mind. They're capable of providing for themselves. Now, there's another category of people who are mentally ill who need some kind of help, but the current mental laws make it very difficult to do anything meaningful for them. But where do you and I disagree? What's the disagreement?
Well, one, I was hoping that we could discuss that because from my personal experience, as I help to run a food pantry in the Fairview area and help 30 families every single week to be able to have food on their tables.
I get that.
As well as I've helped a number of nonprofit groups. From what we've seen, the homeless community is substantial in number on people that have schizophrenia, people that have adult child syndrome, people that obviously need care providers, which I agree with you. The entire county is failing them. They're not getting the medical attention they need.
And they can't. Under the current laws, they can't. It cannot be forced on them. And would you agree with me that to do anything meaningful for many of these people, you would have to force care on them, correct?
That would be correct.
Okay, so and currently the law, I'm not a lawyer, but the lawyers have told me you can't force, you can offer them help, and they can say thanks, no, or they can take it for a while and then walk away from it. So is that person who could be helped, who refuses it, who could work in the cases of those that are able, and by the way, I walk past plenty of them in the downtown area who are able-bodied, sound of mind, and they communicate in a way that makes me believe there's nothing wrong with them, but they could work and they do not. That is a parasite. Can you agree?
Well, my problem is I'm seeing it as a financial.
No. Would you please? I answered your question. Would you answer mine? If somebody can help himself or herself and chooses not to and refuses help to help them be better off and they live, they sponge off society, is that a parasite?
Well, I think we've got different definitions of a parasite.
Well, parasite is a bug that, or a bug or a disease or something that lives off something else and is not helpful. Now, I consider people who say, I could work, but I won't. I could take help, but I won't. I could get off drugs, and I'm being offered help to get off drugs, but I won't. But I want you to provide for my housing, my food, my medical care, and I want you to pay for the treatment and everything else. Is that a parasitical existence?
That is somebody that needs correction.
No, okay, but you, why is it that I answer your questions, but you won't do me the favor of telling me if somebody refuses help and you've offered help and the help is expensive, it takes a lot of time and money and everything else, but you say, I don't want your help. I like being on drugs. I like drinking. I like living on the streets. I like not getting up and going to work every day, but I want you to provide everything for me. If your brother-in-law did that to you, slept on your couch, ate your food, took everything that you offered, but gave back nothing, do you think you could accurately describe your brother-in-law as, or your brother, as a parasite?
I agree with you in that people have to take personal responsibility. And with personal responsibility, there are implements that have to take place.
We're live at the Moore Mansion in Pasco. It's First Amendment Friday. We're up against the break, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's First Amendment Friday, and we're doing it live today from the Moore Mansion in Pasco, Washington, courtesy of the Pecks, who own this beautiful house and have restored it or are in the process of restoring it to its former glory. Most of it looks absolutely beautiful, and I just can't imagine how privileged I feel to be able to stand here and do the broadcast from here. It's a pleasure to be with you as well all over the Pacific Northwest, and we're glad to get your calls. Let me mention one thing before I go to those calls. The former U.S. attorney for the state of Oregon, Amanda Marshall, has now been disciplined for lying about an affair. By the way, isn't the penalty for lying to federal investigators time in prison? Like, say, Martha Stewart spent time in prison. General Mike Flynn, I think, is contesting his guilty plea, but he was also convicted of a serious crime. And yet here's Amanda Marshall, who will be barred from the practice of law for 90 days for lying about a sexual relationship with a lawyer in her office when she was the U.S. attorney. Under the agreement, Marshall, now in private practice, will serve 90 days of a one-year suspension of her law license. She is required to complete a two-year probation. She acknowledged violating a single rule of professional conduct involving dishonesty and misrepresentation. In her initial conversation with a federal official, she denied having sex with a subordinate attorney. She has now admitted it. She lied to federal investigators. We've been hearing now for the last 6 months or so, if you lie to a federal investigator, why, you can end up going to prison. I think George Papadopoulos is going to end up with some time because he lied to federal investigators. And yet, for Amanda Marshall, as far as I'm concerned, 90-day suspension as a lawyer, that's kind of a slap on the wrist. Let's go to Elias. Hey, Elias, welcome to First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, how's it going?
Very well.
Going good. So what's on my mind is tomorrow, Oregonians for Firearms Education and Rights are doing a counter rally to March of Our Lives. And they're meeting downtown at the fountain. And I just want everybody to know to show up without their guns and not to be all crazy about it. And we really need to have some people maybe bring some educational material for the children so that, these kids are being influenced by the other side. And we need to educate them because the kids are so easily influenced. When I sit down and talk with them and actually discuss things with them, they're totally open to having a discussion. And the problem is people are just shutting everything down. We need to educate these kids. So if you show up, bring some material and just some education stuff. And actually, we need to be there. People need to show up. Our Second Amendment rights are in danger right now, more than they
ever
have been.
Elias, that sounds like a very sensible way to do it. Is there a website or a Facebook page that you can recommend people go to if they want the additional details on what you're doing tomorrow to counter this massive march going on in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, I'm going off of a Facebook page. It's called Counter Rally to March of Our Lives. And I just got invited to it by a bunch of my friends, and I'm going there tomorrow. I'm not one of the people to put it together, but I just think everybody should know about it and everybody should show up.
Absolutely right. Elias, thanks a lot for the call. Let's go to Craig, who's calling from Pasco, listening on KONA, our local affiliate here. Hey, Craig, it's First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind?
First of all, I want to say that Moore Mansion is indeed an incredible place. I have been watching that be remodeled for about 30 years now, inside and out, and it's just gorgeous.
I've seen the pictures of what it looked like when the Pecks took it over and what they made it into today. And they, they offered up for weddings. They offered up for all these other events. By the way, Roundtable Pizza just bought by some lunch, and I told them because I'm a type 2, I can only have a slice or two. But I'm being conservative like I try to be. But isn't it great to see something like this restored with private dollars by private parties who are interested in making something wonderful? Not everything comes from a government check.
Absolutely. You opened the program today with a segment about a 17-year-old who took a firearm to a school. And yep, we're lamenting the fact that you cannot get the information that you feel you need to get out for the community to know who this person was. Yep. I have my own solution to firearms and kids is to make the laws where any time that you're in possession of a firearm, I don't care how old you are an adult, because firearms are an adult right.
That's an interesting take, that if you say, if you're in possession of a firearm, even if you're a juvenile, we'll consider you as an adult because you're doing an adult thing. It's one of my favorite authors way back when said he took issue with the term juvenile delinquent. And this fits right in with what you're saying. He said, it's impossible. And the person he was talking to in this story wrote, said, what do you mean it's impossible? He said, juvenile is defined as not adult, right? That's the simplest definition. And yet, delinquent means to fail in duty. And duty is an adult virtue, not a child virtue. Duty is what adults do. When you're a child, you may have a duty like cleaning your room or dumping the garbage, taking the garbage can out for mom. But for the most part, duty is an adult virtue. So how can you fault somebody for being a juvenile who fails in an adult virtue? In your case, you're saying if you've decided as a child to take on things that are only the province of adults, and that is firearms is one of them, then we're going to treat you like an adult when it comes to criminal justice. It still doesn't answer my problem that the local authorities are unwilling to release his name, and they do not have a good reason for it. Now, if I were asking if the, God forbid, the Austin bombing situation was happening here in the Northwest, and I called the police and said, give me all the details on the guy you're looking for, obviously before he blew himself up the other day, they'd say, no, we're holding that back. We're in the middle of an investigation. If we release the details, it might endanger the investigation. But in this case, what's the investigation? The kid took a picture of himself with a gun at school. How much more? You know, they may want to talk to his folks and talk to him and all that, but the investigation is over. I think they're holding it back because they don't want this kid to be embarrassed by the fact that he committed a very serious crime.
Absolutely. Absolutely, you know. And as an adult, if that had been an adult that had been under the same circumstance, his name would have been released to the papers already.
You're absolutely right. And that's one of the things I'm concerned about with this whole idea of restorative justice, that the schools have decided it's not good for a kid to have a criminal record, even if the kid has committed a crime. Let's go to John the Electrician. Hey, John, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind on this First Amendment Friday live from Pasco?
Lars, thank you so much for taking my call, and I am your consummate naysayer. I just wanted to raise a couple of points. The first one's kind of minor, but it's contradictory. It kind of oozes contradiction, and that's. But I'm talking about the students that are protesting tomorrow about never again, changing some gun laws. But yeah. The first point is that a lot of your listeners and yourself have criticized these kids for they're too young. What do they know? What are they going to do? How come? Who are they to tell us adults? And interestingly enough, I've heard you bring on little 13-year-old conservative children onto your show, and who have the parents have put them up in front of the phone, and they'll call you up, and you'll talk some conservative values of some sort, and they get their airtime. And I just found that it's kind of a minor point, but it's
actually it's John. I'm going to tell you something. The only the kids who talk to me. I've never once had somebody say, I'm going to put my kid on the phone and I told him what to say.
No, you're talking to the kid.
No, but when I'm talking to the kid, most of the kids who call me, they call on their own. Now, I can usually tell if a kid has been coached and he's not saying,
you're missing my point.
No, I'm not missing your point. Here's the point. I think that if a young man or woman called me right now and wanted to make the case for something I disagreed with, I'd put them on in a heartbeat. If they wanted to call in and say, I think I should have a right to abortion. I should have a right to whatever. Hold up. What I took issue with was I never said the kids were too young. What I said was they're not telling us what they want, which makes me believe they don't know what they want.
I'm glad you said that because here's the thing. What are the adults doing, Lars?
They are wrangling out what changes to be made. And you'll notice that even when Obama was president and he had two houses, both controlled by Democrats, he didn't pass any gun legislation at all. And he could have.
Everybody's afraid of the NRA.
Well, yeah. Hold on. Why would you? I can tell you why you might be afraid that if you go up against.
Not me. I'm not afraid. I'm talking about Trump.
It's not about Trump.
Trump's afraid of the NRA.
No,
the politicians are afraid of the NRA.
Let me tell you something. Do you want to hear some new information? If you want to hear your own voice, I'll shut up and you can just echo in your own ears.
I mean, you talk a lot, Lars, so go ahead and talk some more.
Donald Trump, from the very beginning of his campaign, was solid on the Second Amendment. Nothing he's doing today goes counter to that, all right? Back in September of 2015, before the 16 election, Donald Trump released a statement about where he stood on guns. He's still in that very same position. He hasn't changed one iota. But what I'm asking of these kids, I used them earlier this week. I said, back during the Vietnam War, when I was in elementary school, there were people marching in the streets about the Vietnam War. Now, I might have disagreed with them, but I knew what they were asking for. They said, we shouldn't be in this war. Take America out of the war. I didn't have to agree with them to know I understand what they're asking for. And that's what they were asking for. Can you tell me, what do these kids want America's government to do?
First off, there's so many kids and so many ideas. What they're saying generally is, by the potentially millions of kids and parents and adults, they're saying that something needs to happen. Never again.
But hold on, John.
We are frozen.
John, that's exactly my point, is that if I say there's a flood coming to Pasco. Now, there's a big levee here that keeps the flood from happening here.
Hey, Lars,
but if I said, hold up, if you don't want to listen, I'll let you go. But if I said there's a flood coming and folks here said, well, Lars, you're in charge or you're voicing an opinion, what would you like? If I said, go stack sandbags over here. That would be one answer. Call the dams upriver.
I know where you're going. Yeah, but these long-winded.
Now, I'll tell you what. Long-winded? I can be as long-winded as you want. But here's the difference. If these children were out in the streets saying, we want this law changed, we want that law changed, we want this kind of gun made illegal, they can do that all day long. But they're not bringing up any new ideas whatsoever that haven't already been considered and rejected by legislatures and by the Congress. So if you say, well, they're brilliant, they've come up with the answer, they've said, change something. Well, saying change something is not a solution. Tell me what the change is. And then I'll tell you whether or not we've already considered the change and rejected it as unacceptable, either constitutionally or otherwise. It's First Amendment Friday. We're live at the Moore Mansion in Pasco with KONA, one of our great Radio Northwest affiliates. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is First Amendment Friday, and your calls are welcome at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. We're live from the Moore Mansion in Pasco, a 110-year-old private home that has been fully restored, not with government money, by the way. Sam Carpenter joins me now, who's running for governor, for the Republican nomination for governor in the state of Oregon. How you doing, Sam?
Hey, Lars. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate that.
Hey, do you mind if I ask you, first of all, so people can get your measure, what do you make of the president's action in signing that $1.3 trillion spending bill today?
I haven't quite caught my breath on that. I don't know what to tell you. I was little bit shocked. I thought that he would veto it for sure, so I don't know what to say. I'm a little speechless about it. Get my thoughts together later.
No worries. Then let's talk about what you would do differently with Oregon if you get the nomination and if you run and beat Kate Brown, who really richly deserves to be replaced. She's a terrible governor.
You're very diplomatic about that statement, Lars. what I would do differently, like, I'm a mechanical guy, I'm an engineer, I fix businesses, that's what I would do. From the May 16th on, I'd be working with our quote-unquote swing House districts and swing Senate districts to take the House and the Senate red, just like what happened in Kentucky 2 years ago. A red trifecta where the Governor Bevin back there in the House and the Senate went red, and they passed right to work in the first week of their first legislative session. That's what we need to do. That's the mechanical thing I'll do, is I'll get this state completely red.
Well, but you're going to have to change something about the voters, aren't you? Because right now we have a Democrat majority in the House, Democrat majority in the Senate. How do you get it red? Isn't that going to take a couple of election cycles before you replace enough reps that you can get to a Republican majority?
Maybe, but I think it can happen in 2018. We Republicans have been intimidated by the other side. There's a 10% difference in the registered Republicans and Democrats, 38-28. And this polling we've done, very scientific polling, we're in our fifth poll now. It'll be released next week, and we may make it public. But independents are upside down. 53% will vote for any generic Republican gubernatorial candidate. 37% will vote for Kate Brown. It's really upside down. And I used to be a Democrat. I used to be a hard hat. I used to run industrial strength union crews right out of the union hall. I can talk to Democrats. We got to get our Democrats to come over. And we do that by not bashing Democrats, but bashing the far left leadership. The far left leadership happens to be Democrat, but bashing all Democrats has been a major mistake. So what we're going to do is avoid some classic Republican mistakes here in Oregon, all along those lines.
Well, so tell me this, Sam, until you get those majorities in both houses and can make those changes like right to work, what are you going to do with the governor's office until then? Because people want to know, if they give you the job, what are you going to do with it?
A couple of things. Governor of Oregon has a lot of power compared to, for instance, the governor of Texas. I can replace executives, these department heads. I can replace people in the committees, in the bureaucracies. I can go down the line and put people in who want to make Oregon great again.com. And the other thing is, as a Republican governor, I'll be a veto machine if I have to be. And I will be, because the government's too big. It's too invasive, and I'm talking to your audience, and I'm singing to the choir. I understand that. But something's actually got to be done. And one of the biggest mistakes we've made, Lars, is being intimidated, crossing the aisle. Come on, we've been crossing the aisle for 30 years. It doesn't work. They're laughing at us. And this is the progressive far left, not all Democrats. There's a lot of disgusted Democrats out there, too.
I don't doubt it. Sam, tell people again your website.
MakeOregonGreatAgain.com. And let me squeeze in the Facebook page, which is a lot of fun. We're pushing 100,000 followers. Sam Carpenter for Oregon. It's a lot of fun.
Sam Carpenter for Oregon on Facebook. Sam, thank you very much. I appreciate it. It's First Amendment Friday live from Pasco today with KONA, and you've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is First Amendment Friday. We're live from the Moore Mansion in Pasco. It's not open to the public, but I'm sure the Pecks appreciate me mentioning that. But there are times they have weddings here. There are times they have public events here. Today just doesn't have to be one of them. It's a pleasure to be with you for First Amendment Friday, and I'm glad to get your calls at 866-439-5277. First, I want to go to Todd Myers. And Todd is a great friend of the program. And, of course, we're always glad to have him on to talk about some of the idiocy that goes on in various places, including the state of Washington. Todd, how are you?
I'm doing very well. And one of the things you should see in Pasco is Reactor B on the Hanford site, which was the site of the first reactor that built the atomic bomb. It's a national monument, and it's just fantastic.
I should get a chance to see that because I'm proud of the fact that our country decided to perfect that technology far enough that it could be used and then use it sensibly twice, and we've never had to use it again. Kind of like a lot of potential threats that you might make as a country. If you do that to us, you'll be sorry, and we haven't had to use them again. I want to ask you about this. Cities want to now banned plastic bags. I assume they don't like paper bags because those are made out of dead trees. And now they want to ban the so-called organic cotton grocery bags as well?
Well, that's my tongue-in-cheek recommendation, because what ends up happening, of course, is that the cities ban plastic bags, and then they don't ban the paper bags. They just offer a charge, right, a 5-cent or a dime charge for using a paper bag. But what they do is they encourage people to use cotton bags and sometimes even organic cotton bags. But what the research shows is that organic cotton bags are far and away the worst for the environment, both in terms of the amount of energy they use and in terms of water pollution. So the recommendation I've made is that you should, get rid of the plastic bag ban. But if you won't do that, you should ban what is clearly the worst choice for the environment, and that is organic cotton bags.
Let me ask you, just so I know the details on this, the water use is from producing the bag, or is it from laundering the bag? Or do you even assume that the folks who use the organic cotton bag are laundering the thing from time to time?
Yeah, in this analysis, it didn't even take into account how much the water used to clean the bag.
Oh.
It is growing the cotton, and then, of course, putting the fertilizer in the ground and doing all the other things that you need to grow the cotton. And organic cotton bags are actually three times as wasteful as just regular cotton bags, because organic cotton bags, they don't use a lot of pesticides, or they use pesticides that don't work as well. And so sometimes they lose large portions of their crop, or their yields are low, which means you're putting a lot of energy, a lot of fertilizer and other things like that into the ground that yields literally nothing. So organic cotton actually has three times the impact of cotton bags, which means that if you got an organic cotton bag, you would have to use your bag 153 times, basically once a week for 3 years, just to break even compared to a plastic bags.
Once a week for 3 years, and this would assume you wouldn't wash it. And the reason I ask about that, Todd, is that when I hear people say, well, I use a recycled bag, and I said, oh, so you're the person who comes in and sets their bag on the belt at the grocery store where my food is, and the bottom of it is covered with whatever it accumulated while it was either in your car, in the trunk, in the garage, on the kitchen floor, around the dog's dish, or anywhere else. I assume that even the natural types that use those things probably want to wash them from time to time, but probably not nearly enough.
Yeah, and when they do, they use the detergent, they use the water, they use the energy to to wash and then to dry them, and that adds up. But even before all of that happens, they're worse for the environment. And what people don't think about is people think about, well, we ban plastic bags to help marine mammals and keep them out of the water. But all of that fertilizer and other things, a portion of it runs off into the water, and that's actually a far bigger problem for water quality. And so what this most recent study out of Denmark found is that organic cotton bags cause about 600 times as much water pollution as plastic bags, which means you'd have to use them once a week for 11 and a half years just to break even on water pollution. So organic cotton bags are very, they use a lot of resources. And really what I'm just trying to point out here is a lot of decisions that get made on the environment are about what feels good and what sounds good, not what the science actually says.
Absolutely. Now, how about smartphones? You see that smartphones can actually be used to make water more available to people. What kind of magic is this?
Yeah. So the beauty is that, you know, when the EPA was created in 1972, if people wanted to get together to do something, it was very difficult. So what we did is we said, all right, government, go ahead and act on our behalf. We don't need to do that anymore in many cases. Smartphones give us the ability to collaborate and work together. And where we're seeing this is not in the United States, where government has crowded those ideas out, but in Africa. In Africa, yesterday was World Water Day, and what you're seeing is that smartphones are being used to allow people to pay for water systems and then keep those water systems working and in good proper order. So people who used to have to travel, you know, an hour to get water, you know, each way, now have pumps that work in their community and they can pay for them from their smartphone. And the ability to coordinate and collaborate using smartphones rather than having to go through government is far more effective. And it's what I call smartphone environmentalism, and we're seeing it in the United States, but we're also seeing it around the world, and it's really a fantastic opportunity both to get clean water and water for people who previously didn't have it.
Hey, I have a proposal for you, Todd. I don't know how this one would pencil out, because again, sometimes the thing that seems like it would make sense when you actually apply the numbers does not. But I mentioned that I'm doing the broadcast today on First Amendment Friday from the Moore Mansion, which itself is an example of recycling, because they tore down an old hotel, a hotel that was displaced by some other actions in Seattle, called the Washington, which was the hotel of the day. Roosevelt stayed there as its very first guest way back in the day. And some of that hotel is in the house that I'm standing in today. It's a big, amazing, grand house that's sitting here next to the Columbia River in Pasco. So here's where I get to the point. I was talking to the current owners who've brought it back to its near to its former glory. They're taking all the original pieces and redoing them, and where there's rot, replacing the rot. But they're doing it with private money. They're doing it with their own money, and they're doing it because it hosts weddings and things like that. But I was talking to them about Washington, D.C., because they had spent some time in Washington, D.C., and I said, you know, I'm frustrated that members of Congress are constantly traveling back and forth between Washington, D.C. and their district. I'd prefer them stay in their districts most of the time. I know that they budget 26 round trips every year for every member of Congress. Now, I don't know what the carbon footprint of 26 round trip airplane flights. They're flying commercial. They're not on private planes or military planes. But if you could take every member of Congress, 535 of them, and say most of the time when you need to be represented in Washington, D.C., let's do it with video conferencing. I mean, I video conference with my soon-to-be two-year-old granddaughter every night by phone. You know, it's not technology that's beyond the reach of the United States Congress. If you could leave members of Congress in their districts most of the time, and then, you know, a couple of times a year they could go to D.C. if they really feel they have to have in-person meetings, but the rest of the time, take the testimony and give their thoughts and cast their votes electronically instead of transporting these 535 members back and forth 26 times a year. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it would make a big difference. I think both you and I have taken red-eye flights to Washington, D.C. Oh. You don't do your best work the next day. That's certainly the case. So there is that. But I think that's true, but it works in both directions as well. At the Washington Policy Center, where I work, during the legislative session, we do the other way around, which is while everyone is in Olympia, we have breakfasts where we will have the legislator or legislators do a video conference with constituents residents in their community while they're in Olympia. We also have another proposal that we've worked on that allows people in Eastern Washington to testify before committees from Eastern Washington. You know, it's sometimes hard to get across the pass during with snow, and being and giving them the opportunity to testify from their homes makes government more open and transparent. Not to mention, it saves energy and fuel and cost and all those other things. And I think that's what you see is a lot of what is good for the environment is good economics. Economics is a tremendous driver for using less fuel, using fewer resources, and helping the environment. I think too many people on the left don't realize that. We on the right do, and we should take advantage of good economics to help the environment.
Todd Myers is the environmental director for the Washington Policy Center. We always appreciate his insights. Todd, thank you very much for the time.
It was great to talk with you.
Glad to have you on the program. It's First Amendment Friday. Back in just a moment. 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It is First Amendment Friday. We're live in the Moore Mansion in Pasco, Washington, with our local affiliate. And our local affiliate is KONA, News Radio 610. And standing in front of me is Brad Peck. How are you doing, Mr. Peck?
I'm doing great, Lars. Thanks.
Thank you for letting me use your living room. And this is quite a living room. I'm going to put pictures up on the website. This is the Moore Mansion, and you and your wife are the owners of this. Tell me about the house.
Well, it's a 1908 neoclassical place. James Moore built it for people in Seattle. I think they recognize the name. He's famous for the Moore Theater and a bunch of other things in Seattle. And, you know, we don't get any credit for the house, the architecture, or anything else, just maybe having either courage or enough craziness in us to take this on and restore it.
Part of this house used to be part of the hotel in the state of Washington. Tell me about that.
The Washington, as it was known, up on top of Denny Hill, overlooking Pike Place Market, had to come down in the, 1905, 6-7 Denny regrade, somewhere in there. They took 100 feet off of Denny Hill. And, of course, the hotel had to come down, and in a stroke of early American recycling and reuse, Mr. Moore brought a bunch of the nicer components, like the 10-foot oak fireplace behind you, came out of that hotel, as did many of the nicer components in the house.
Beautiful. Who was the very first guest of the Washington?
The story, and it appears to be pretty accurate, is that Theodore Roosevelt, after McKinley was assassinated and Roosevelt becomes president, is touring the Northwest, and he is the very first guest in the Washington on top of Denny Hill before it came down. And it's pretty neat connection, actually.
Now, you have a government job.
I do. I have.
Well, you flew airplanes for the Air Force first, but and you've done a lot of other things, but this is a government job here in Franklin County, right?
Well, I only flew very briefly for the Air Force starting out, just some training opportunities. They threw me out on a medical, but that's another story, another life. I have what I think is one of the better jobs that a person can have today, and that's an advocate for the people of Franklin County. The title is county commissioner, but I think it's an advocacy job.
Now, what do you at? Well, then what do you stand for? You're a conservative, right?
Well, I am. I think most anybody in the community would tell you, by most measures. No, I just feel very deeply that people in these county commissioner positions in particular should be advocates on behalf of the citizens with their government. Even though I'm part of the government, that gives me an opportunity to be part of the solution. I'm big on private land rights, for example, lawful enjoyment of people's their private property. Very concerned about water rights.
You mean being able to punch your own water well and supply your house with water?
Well, you would think so. thank you, Supreme Court, but also thank you, legislature, for helping get the Hearst situation straightened out.
Is it straightened out now? I mean, did that really...
No.
Did it do
no,
but some, most, all?
It took a lot of the immediate concern out. We had landowners who, frankly, weren't certain if they could punch a well, even under one of the exempt uses, say, for drinking water in your house. Even that was unclear. So making progress, long ways to go. But, you know, we could get into the whole Growth Management Act, but it would take 18 shows.
And we'd have to go off on a number of other tangents
yes,
as well.
I
want to go back to the house for a second.
Okay.
I admire the fact that you and your wife took this on. Could you describe in 20 seconds what this place looked like when you bought it?
Well, unfortunately, your listeners can't see the photo that we're looking at, but most people we show it to, they simply say, my goodness, what were you thinking? And I think my best answer is I'm not sure we were. But, you know, that was 2004, and we bought it 2 days before the wrecking ball, almost literally. And so here we are 13 years later, probably one of the better decisions, short of marrying my wife of 30-some years, probably one of the best decisions I've made.
And it's
we've made.
And it's a beautiful house, and you open it up to things like, well, you're letting me broadcast here. You also have weddings here.
Well, letting you broadcast here is actually our privilege, but for weddings, that's my wife's business. And it really is a great illustration of what I think needs to happen with a lot of historic properties that are either so big or so costly that you can't justify doing it out of your pocket. And so in this case, you embed a small business. There aren't huge tax benefits or anything. There are some small ones, but it just creates enough cash flow that you can actually make it work. But the best part is, in the 10 years she's been doing weddings, I would estimate there's somewhere in the neighborhood of 40,000 people in the community.
Wow.
That have had the opportunity to be around and on a very limited fashion inside the house. So it keeps it available to the public, is not a burden on the taxpayers, and hopefully someday builds equity for my grandkids.
See, I love that you preserve history this way, but you don't say to the government, well, you've got to write me a giant check to make this happen, because that's typically the way people do it today. God bless you for doing it that way.
It's not the government's responsibility, and it's not the government's house. It's my house, so it's my responsibility.
You were telling me some of the history of this. Some of the first apples exported?
Well, the house is listed on the National Register of Historic Places, and in that write-up, which was done back in the 70s, not by me, it cites that the first rail car or large commercial shipment of apples out of Washington allegedly came off of Moore's Farm. I mean, that's in the...
He had, what, 300 acres?
In the federal record.
Or 300 trees?
Well, he had about 1,200 acres, yeah. And he had somewhere, depending on whose count you use, 20 to 30,000 fruit trees of a variety. A lot of peach trees back there, incidentally. Peach trees and Concord grapes, as well as apples and other things.
So all of this that was going on before was a commercial going operation then. It is one today. You have an event center here as well, 4,000 square feet, and people can come have a community event here.
Well, our events are primarily outdoors.
Right.
We do have a new, it's actually about 8,000 square feet of support buildings. It's got nice restrooms, meeting rooms, those kinds of things. And truthfully, there's very limited use inside the historic house just because our first mission is to preserve and protect the history, and so we try to balance that use.
And you've done all that. It absolutely looks fantastic, and I know it's a work in progress. I can see the stairs.
Thank you.
The stairs aren't done yet, but they're getting there, right?
Well, it takes longer when you do it with your own hands and your own money.
See, I do some with my own hands, but as Clint Eastwood said, a man has to know his limitations. Mr. Peck, it's a pleasure to be in your house, you and your wife letting me broadcast here. It's First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a First Amendment Friday. We're live on the Radio Northwest Network throughout the state of Oregon, and we're glad, and Washington, and Idaho, because we're all over the Pacific Northwest, and today I'm in Pasco, Washington. I'm standing here in the living room at the Moore Mansion in Pasco, and it's a real pleasure to be here, and I'm glad to get your phone calls and your emails, too. A lot of people talking about the proposal that was made this week, an initiative petition in Oregon that would propose confiscation of some firearms, many firearms, from the hands of American citizens who live in the state of Oregon, and also from any who travel through the state of Oregon or to the state of Oregon. So that's on the agenda. The president's decision to sign that $1.3 trillion spending bill, that is another issue that is before us as well. And I want to get to your phone calls and emails, too. Let's go first to Jim in Coquille. Hey, Jim, thanks for listening on KWRO on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Well, what I called about was that 747 fire plane that you're thrilled with.
Yes.
Well, now that they've got the gig down in California and, who knows, maybe in Oregon, are they going to build any more of them?
Well, at this point, there isn't. If the need is there, they have told me that they could imagine having a number of them. But some of the reason that there may not be the need immediately, Jim, is that this airplane, what he's talking about is the GST, the Global Supertanker. And what it does is it's the biggest, cheapest, fastest firefighting rig in the air, in the world, anywhere in the world, and there's only one like it. It travels 600 miles an hour. Now, it's an old, not old, but I mean, almost all airplanes are not brand spanking new, because you'll see planes in the air that are 30 years old, 40 years old. It'll go almost anywhere at 600 miles an hour. So if they based one of them out of their current headquarters in Colorado Springs, Colorado, where the Air Force Academy is, they can be anywhere in the lower 48 in about 4 hours. They can be in Alaska in 5.5 hours. They can be in Australia in about 16 hours. And so far, because the fire seasons hit different continents at different times, they've been able to do jobs in Chile. They've done jobs in Israel. They've done jobs in Mexico. And so if they begin doing enough of those things that it justifies it, remember, it's a commercial business, then they would probably build a second or third or fourth. At this point, if you had one in America and you had fires break out in, say, Florida in the Everglades, they have fires there occasionally at a certain time of year, you could be there in 4 hours and start dumping water on them. And it is a somewhat specialized tool in that it's not going to be for every fire out there. But I imagine if they get enough use of it, they'll build a second one. They already have the technology. They can buy a used 747 cargo plane, make sure the avionics in it are good, and put in the system in the back, and they could have a second one. But that's going to depend on demand, because unlike the government, they don't just go out and build things and then look for the marketplace. They're looking for the marketplace now. California used it last summer. Oregon has now done an on-call or will on, what's it's called, not on demand, but they have a contract that they can call the plane up and make use of it. So far we have 2 out of 50 states, and the U.S. Forest Service still, one, refuses to use it, two, refuses to explain why they won't use it, and I have hit up the Secretary of Agriculture, because the Forest Service is in agriculture, not in interior. I've asked both the Interior Secretary and the Agriculture Secretary, why won't your bureaucracy use it? They literally wrote the contracts for air tankers so that this tanker does not qualify. They said, we will not take a tanker bigger than 5,000 gallons. This thing holds over 19,000 gallons. And so you wonder, why, if you've got fire problems every year, why would you refuse to call the biggest, fastest, and by the way, per gallon drop, cheapest firefighting tanker? So far, the Forest Service won't tell me. So, does that answer your question?
Well, it just seems like last year there were 3 or 4 fires going at the same time in California. Plus, they had that big one that was 240,000 acres where they could have used 2 or 3 at the same
time. Oh, you mean the one in Oregon that started out at 1/4 acre, and then it grew to 3 or 4 acres, and they ignored it long enough that it got to 15,000, and then it took off and went for the moon and went to 250,000?
Well, that one, too, could have used it. But, I mean, that big one down in Southern California that where now they're having all those mudslides, you know, they could have used 3 or 4 of them on the same fire, it seems.
Yeah, they could. And someday, Jim, they may have 2 or 3 or 4 of them. But I think a 4-7 cargo plane is about 50 to $70 million just to buy the plane. Then you got to put the technology in it. You have to have the pilots that are trained to fly it. And they fly with a crew of 3 up front, you know, pilot, co-pilot, engineer. And so when the demand is there, I'm sure they'll build it. But these things are built by private industry, not by the government. So when you ask private industry to sink, I don't know, $80 million into an aircraft, there better be some jobs for it. Nobody buys a long-haul truck without having some loads that they want to carry.
But it just seems like it's such a great fire tool. The more you have, the better. I don't know.
Well, wait till it fights a few fires in Oregon next summer, and then watch what happens. Because I kept thinking that the folks in D.C., like the Ag Secretary, would turn on the TV. He said he had never heard of the global supertanker. There were news organizations, including national ones, that were doing stories about this huge, unique plane fighting fires in California. And yet somehow the Agriculture Secretary, Sonny Perdue, had no idea that the plane even existed. Now, that might tell you something about the government, too. Let's go to Rebecca. Hey, Rebecca, welcome to First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind?
Good afternoon, Lars. I just wanted to comment on the students who are marching, and you've asked the question, why? What is their solution? What are they trying to say? And I've talked to some of those students, and what I'm hearing is that they want to be heard. They want to have a voice, and they don't have many ways to do that because of their age. And the ones I've talked to aren't saying we have solutions. We're begging the adults in our lives to come up with solutions because we want them to know that we care, we're concerned, and how else do we do it? This is one way for us to have a voice. That's what I'm hearing. Not so much as they're saying, we're going to tell you what to do, and then we don't hear what they suggest because they don't necessarily have solutions. They're the kids. They're the ones that want to speak out and say, we care, we're concerned, we're passionate about hoping that you come up with something and if there's anything we can do. And I think that makes sense. How else are they going to respond?
Well, Rebecca, I got to tell you something. I don't think, if that's truly what they're saying, I don't think it's accurate, and I'll tell you why. In this day and age, they have more ways to be heard than human beings have ever had to be heard before. If you post something unique and thoughtful on the internet through Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and 100 other places, and it's unique. It will propagate across the planet, sometimes literally in seconds. If Donald Trump says something outrageous, it's in every corner of the world that fast, because people see it and they say, wow, did you see what he said? And they pass it on to 100 of their friends. So number one, they have a way to be heard. Number two, if I were sitting in church and I told the pastor, Pastor, I have something to say. And he said, well, if you've got something important to say, go up and say it. And I just stood up and just started talking. Hi, it's nice to be here. I'm really concerned about the problems we have here in the world today. And 5 minutes into that, when the congregation heard me saying nothing, just, you know, saying words, but not actually saying, here's how we solve it, I think I'd have a problem. Third, they have posted on their website, ban semi-automatic weapons that fire high-velocity rounds. That's all of them. That's all of them. They all fire high-velocity rounds. Number two.
Now, when you say they, who do you mean?
This is the post on their website.
Who's
that they have put, what, the group that is sponsoring this march that is, I guess, forecast to draw 1 million people to Washington, D.C. tomorrow. Now, it may be that the weather will hold that down. I kind of expect that it will. They want to establish a database of gun sales and universal background checks. Well, a database that can be checked by whom? And why? Why would I, as a citizen, want to be in that database if I just simply want to establish? In fact, I'll throw you an idea. You want a database of everybody who owns a gun, 99.9% of whom will never commit a crime? Let's have a database of every Muslim in America, and we're going to make it a publicly searchable database. Do you think that would go over? Because we're talking about two civil rights there, the right to practice your religion and the right to keep and bear arms. They want to have a database of me and everyone else out there who owns a firearm to be used for what? We've already seen what databases can be used for if Cambridge Analytica gets a hold of them, right? They will use it for things that are not things that you would sign off on. And they would say merely by practicing your Second Amendment rights, you end up in a government database. And what are people going to do with that database?
Well, I will say, Lars, that the young people I've talked to, many of them are posting things. They also want to be seen, and they want to make a statement. And I think that the statement is they care, they're concerned, they want the adults to do something. And the adults are putting down the reasons why they think there should be more gun controls. The young people are saying, please, do something. You're the adults. We don't feel safe when we go to school. And they're posting things. The ones I know are posting things. They're getting the word out that way. But they want their face to be seen. They're passionate.
What is the point of that?
Why don't we want them to? Why do we not want our young people to care?
Rebecca, respectfully, I want them to care. But just merely standing up and saying, I care. Well, what are you doing? I mean, if somebody's house got burned down tonight, God forbid, somebody's house will burn down sometime this week. It's going to happen somewhere in America. And you stood up and said, I really care about the people in that house. You might reasonably say, well, what do you want to do for them?
Well,
I'm not going to feed them. I'm not going to clothe them. I'm not going to put them up at my house. I don't even have any suggestions about how they get their house back or anything else.
It shows
I just want
the
to tell
people
them I care.
They care. It shows the people in that family that somebody cares, that somebody's paying attention, and they want that family to know that, even though they don't know the family. And I think we want our young people to pay attention to what's happening in the world, and maybe we as adults need to give them better ways. I see that they are sending that message out on social media. They also are taking to the streets because they care. Why do we want to prevent our young people from taking their passion about safety and safety in their schools and for their own selves? Do we want them to sit home and be on their computer? Do we want them?
They may not have solutions.
They're kids. They may not have solutions. That's our job.
Well, and we've done that. We've considered all the solutions they've suggested, and we've said there are various reasons why those solutions don't work. And oftentimes, kids will say, I want us to change this. If dad comes home and says, I lost my job, and his son says, well, I care about that. I'm concerned that you lost your job. Change to a different industry. There may be a lot of reasons you can't. Let's move to a different town. There may be a lot of reasons you can't. And most of the things they're asking for have already been considered and rejected for various reasons that they apparently do not understand, which makes it tough to include them in the conversation if they say, I want to talk about this, but I don't know anything about the subject. We're live from the Moore Mansion in Pasco, Washington, with our local affiliate KONA, and it's First Amendment Friday on the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, live from the Moore Mansion in Pasco for First Amendment Friday. And I've asked Clinton Perry to join me because, well, Clinton's a dad, and he emailed me, and I thought he had a couple of interesting things to say about what's happening to his third-grade daughter, who's in school right now in Rogue River Elementary School. Clinton, welcome to the program. What are they doing to your daughter at school?
Well, sir, this year she joined the Oregon Battle of the Books competition. It's a reading competition that's statewide, and she was actually the first third grader to ever make the team in Rogue River Elementary School's history. So I was very proud of her, and I support her reading all the way. So what we found out after she won the elementary school competition and went to the regional contest, and after that contest, her teacher explained to me that there was a controversial book already selected for next year's reading material. So they picked 16 books in advance, and the titles are selected so far in advance that first and sometimes second year parents miss the window to give feedback or to voice their concerns about the titles that are selected. And that's the case with us. So for next year's book selection, out of the 16 books, they picked a book that will be about transgender ideology. And this targets third to fifth grade students. So the books are, or the competition is based on questions about all 16 books. So if a child decides to opt out of reading one of those books, then they are unable to answer the questions, and hence their answers are wrong. And in our case, our team lost by one question. So every question matters. And it seems to be that children from religious households are being either told to violate their belief system or to take a penalty in the competition or to not be involved. And all three of those seem hurtful and excuses.
Sounds like it to me as well. It sounds like you either agree to allow your child to be indoctrinated by reading a certain section of books, a certain number of books and titles, or they're out of the competition altogether, and then they don't get that opportunity simply because they won't, I guess, put their beliefs and the values of their parents and themselves second to this competition.
Yeah, and that's kind of my main concern with it, is that children as young as 8 years old, you know, they're being taught to that permanently changing their bodies is an option, or that their reproductive organs can be surgically removed, or that gender is a mental state or fluid, or that the science of biology is just an inconvenience, or not to accept themselves as the way they were born. This is all 3 years before sex ed even begins for these children. So they're taught, you know, that these reproductive organs can possibly be removed or changed, but they haven't even been taught what they're for, how they work, what's safe, or why.
And so, these are all kids that are anywhere from eight to 10 years of age.
And the contest goes up into high school as well, but it starts from the third grade. And in our school group was a third to fifth grade group. And then the sixth graders are somewhat separated. And then the high school and middle school kids are also separated. So I see no reason whatsoever for these eight-year-olds to be indoctrinated this way.
Yeah, why not some classic literature rather than right. literature that is about controversial subjects like that?
Right, and by trusting that the reading material is wholesome, as most parents would, or by just being enthusiastic about their child joining a reading club, parents may not be aware that the Oregon Battle of the Books title committee would coerce children as young as eight to read books that violate their family's religion, trust, or belief system. And children that want to participate but want to opt out of the book, they must face this point disadvantage. And it just seems unfair to me, and it seems to exclude innocent young children, which I didn't think that aligned with Oregon's ideals.
No, it doesn't at all. Mr. Perry, I appreciate you telling that story. I'm going to see. I'll be willing to talk to anybody from the competition or from the folks who are on the selection committee for these books. Why would you force books like that on kids or say to them, if you aren't willing to read these books, then you can't be in the competition? It is First Amendment Friday. We're live on the Radio Northwest Network, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. What do you make of Clinton's story? Because this is a man who emailed me, and he gave me the whole description of what he told you on the air. But imagine being told that you're third grader, 8 years of age, to be in part of this reading program, this competition, you have to read from the 16 books. And some of the books may have objectionable content. Now, I'm thinking objectionable content has a pretty broad definition when you're talking about eight-year-olds. It may be one thing to say, well, I don't think that book is right for a 16-year-old, or I don't think it's right for a 12-year-old. But at age eight, I would put some pretty stiff limits on what is it you think is appropriate for an eight-year-old to. And he's saying they're telling her that, you know, transgender and this and that and stuff they're not even going to cover till sex ed 3 years from now. But somehow this eight-year-old is going to read and comprehend a book about a boy who was born a girl, but now is going to have all the things done to make the changeover. And you think that's appropriate, but if your kid doesn't want to read it, you think it's inappropriate, then your child's not allowed in the competition. Or they can come in, but having not read one of the books, they're going to miss points when it comes to that final exam. Does that make sense for the kind of thing you should push in public schools? Doesn't to me. Let's go to Kate. Hey, Kate, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. How are you?
Hi, Lars. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I'm the mom of a disabled student, and she's fought really, really hard for the privilege to be in a public school. And I'm calling because I'm so concerned that I was misled by my daughter's high school administration into keeping my daughter in school on the day of the protests with lots of reassurance about what would happen, and they broke every promise they made to me. And now I'm really concerned about the fallout that's happening to my daughter because she chose not to participate, and she was the only person in her classroom who didn't.
She should have had the right to not participate. What did they tell you is going, what's going to happen to her as a result of her choice not to participate? Do you know?
Well, I want to be clear. Nobody said, you know, we are going to retaliate you. What happened is that I had addressed some concerns with the vice principal the morning of, because on the night before, the school had sent a last-minute memo basically endorsing the political group, and I had found evidence online that the national political group showed my daughter's high school as an endorser of this, you know, totally partisan cause. And so I'd met with the vice principal that morning just saying, you know, I have a disabled child. I don't want a lot of controversy. This seems like it's gotten out of hand. I'd like to remove her. And he gave me all kinds of assurances that, no, 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 this is just a memorial for the dead, and it's not going to affect class at all. She will be, you know, there will be no effect to her. It's all by the book. We just have to do this for kids' safety. And I attended the rally, and that turned out not to be true, but we can talk about that in a minute. But what has happened as fallout to my daughter is that she's now really depressed, and she's begging me to stop addressing the issue with the school because she is afraid of retaliation like happened to her after the 2012 election when we were in the midst of trying to get her disability services, and then after we took her school to task back then over straw-polling the kids. And they found out how we voted, all of a sudden for 4 years, her disability case was put on hold.
Well, and it could be even milder than that. She could just feel sort of a chill from either fellow students or from the teacher, too. And it could be something that would be very difficult to point a finger at, right?
Yeah, and it's not appropriate. And now she's telling me, you know, please, Mom, don't address this. I remember how this held up my disability case for 4 years. I wish I had just gone along with that march, because now people are telling me that I'm a horrible person and I want children to die.
Oh, boy, that's wrong. That is just dead wrong, and that has to stop. You want to talk about bullying. That, to me, is quintessential bullying.
Right. And especially the way I was falsely induced into leading her. They know. This school was actually helpful. They were the first school to give her the disability services. So they know her background. And I specifically said, you know, how important this was to us that she not be negatively impacted by this. And they swore it wasn't endorsed, that I was misled, that the national site lied, that it was just about the student's safety. And you want to know something else? This school withheld from me and other parents until after the rally that there was actually a credible gun threat resulting in arrest at that school 24 hours earlier, And that principal looked me in the eye and said, oh, no, we're doing everything with the students' safety in mind. Had I known there had been an actual gun in that school the day before, I would not have even sent my daughter.
Was this the young man who was arrested for taking the picture of the gun in his waistband?
Yeah.
This is the one where the police and the courts won't tell me, and I filed a formal public records request. I got the answer last night. They turned me down and said, you cannot know who this student was, even though he was charged with crimes. A couple of them.
Right.
That's right. Hold on for just a moment. I want you to talk to my producers. I want to get your contact information. We'll do what we can to follow up on this one. Let me go to David in Bremerton. David, it's First Amendment Friday. Welcome to the program. Thanks for listening on KVI. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. Just relaxing, enjoying the Friday. But I want to call and ask your opinion on, you know, the couple that decided not to bake the cake for the gay wedding.
Yeah.
And I was asking, how come it is okay for the government to have discrimination laws against, you know, your gender and ethnicity, but not your sexuality, when you don't have a choice in either of those?
I think I get the comparison you're making, that you're saying the government has rules, laws as well, that say you cannot discriminate based on race, gender, et cetera. But when it comes to baking the cake, that if you open, their argument is going to be this, and I know how their argument works, but I think it fails. They're going to say that when you decide to open yourself up for business, so say you open a hotel somewhere, and you say, but I don't want to rent rooms to Muslims. You're not allowed to do that because you're discriminating based on religion. If you say, I have a gas station, but I don't sell gas to Hispanic people, that would also be illegal because it's discrimination. And they're saying this is the same. I don't see it as the same. You're going to a cake shop. They would have sold them a cake. What they ordered was a specific designed for that event wedding cake. And they said, look, we'll sell you a cake, but we don't want to participate at the time, an illegal wedding, and we choose not to. And the end result was they weren't, see, to my mind, and this may seem a narrow legal distinction, but if you say, I will not sell gasoline to someone who is black, that's racism per se. But if you say, I don't want to sell, if a group of people, say, a group like Black Lives Matter comes along and says, we'd like to have a protest and we'd like to do it partly on your property, or we'd like to have some space on your property, and you say, I don't want to be associated with your group, are you discriminating against those people because they're black, or are you discriminating against that activity and that group? And I think there is a difference there. Maybe I haven't explained it perfectly, but that's the gist of it. And that one, I'm still waiting to see whether or not we get some different court decisions that come up with a different result from that. Let's go to Mike in Boardman. Mike, I just drove through Boardman last night on my way up here to Pasco, where we're doing the broadcast today from the Moore Mansion. What's on your mind on this First Amendment Friday?
Mike, I just drove through Boardman last night.
Mike's not listening, I think. Mike, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
What's on your mind?
Well, I was just listening about all these kids walking out, and they're blaming the government, and they blame guns, and they want to, you know, these kids just, they're not sure. They're being driven by, I agree with you, being driven by a bunch of liberals, and because who would dare, you know, criticize a child for what they're saying. But let's be honest. Let's put the blame where the blame lies. The blame lies with the parents. The blame lies with the peers in their school. I mean, you know, I'm sure all these kids that have done these shootings have talked to their peers, made comments, and their peers are too afraid or whatever to rat their buddy out. The schools are saying, don't arrest kids that commit violence in our schools.
Yep.
You know, the police officers neglect what they're supposed to do. And, you know, the people that live around us. I mean, you know, every time you hear about a big shooting, a mass shooting, where the first words, well, that's the price. Well, you know, that kind of makes sense now that that person made that comment. Now that makes sense. You know, so, I mean, it's not guns. It's not, you know, I'm sorry.
Well, Mike, I think there's a, you know, believe it or not, there is a simple solution, at least to what happened in Florida and things like it. And I've suggested, and you suggested to some extent in your comments, if you tell the schools, when you see students who've broken the law, they've made a threat to kill somebody, which Nick Cruz did long before he shot that school up, you call the police and you say, this person has made a credible threat, that's a crime, And you let the courts and the cops work together. The courts, though, or the schools have decided that they're not going to do that because it's more convenient for them to say nobody ever gets arrested at our school because we don't call the police. And for the police, to some extent, for Broward's, you know, the Broward County Sheriff's Department, was more convenient for them. They didn't have to arrest anyone. And the courts, right, of course, didn't have to deal with it. And I guess it all works great until one day one of those kids that you've ignored while he's committing lesser crimes, like merely threatening to kill somebody, turns around and actually kills somebody. If the kids wanted to suggest a great solution that could be implemented starting Monday morning at every school in America, that would be one piece of it. But they're not suggesting that. They're talking about the same kinds of things that some of their liberal elders have proposed for years, but have never put into law because America's representatives, both state and federal, have said, we are not doing that. And there's a reason we don't do it. And I don't think the kids understand that, perhaps. Or maybe they do understand it, and maybe they understand that they're being used as pawns, as a stalking horse to, you know, to act where the adults figure they can't act. It is First Amendment Friday. We're live here at the Moore Mansion in Pasco, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
Look for the union label.
You know what I love? Paying union dues, just so I can keep my job.
I think it's great that my union dues are going to politicians I don't even like.
Thanks, union bosses.
Join the union tonight.
Another great American idea forced upon us by the government to take more of our money and give them control. They are the unions. Now to expose them and break them to pieces, here's Lars Larson.
Well, we got to win when it comes to unions. The Oregon Supreme Court has partially sided with the sponsors of a union transparency initiative after they appealed the title given to their proposal by the state attorney general. You see, state attorney general is a union-loving Democrat named Ellen Rosenblum, and she decided to write one of these ballot titles that gets people not to vote for the initiative. The Supreme Court disagreed, and they said they have now sent it back and told Rosenblum to rewrite it. They wanted a more concise, neutral description of the measure, but if Initiative Petition 34 passes, it would move Oregon toward becoming a right-to-work state. And in a right-to-work state, if you come to work at a workplace, you don't have to join the union. It's your choice. It actually would be very good for unions, because unions like retail stores would have to say, come to our store. We're going to offer you something of value. If you go to a store and you find nothing of value there, you leave and you never buy anything. Well, right now, if you find nothing of value in your union's representation of you, you don't have the right to leave. And it would be nice to be able to leave. Let me go to Lon, who's calling in. Lon, you had a comment on the teacher who about not the teacher or the parent. Which one?
Well, it was about some of the things the teacher said. First off, thanks for taking my call, Lars. I appreciate it. Long time listener, and I called several times. So a couple of the points that she missed is, number one, we're still talking about kids. They haven't, they don't have answers because they don't know things yet. When I was a kid, you know, my parents were dumb, things were terrible, and I had all the solutions in the world. Well, I'm a lot older than that now. It's amazing how intelligent my parents have grown in that intervening time. So they are kids, and we understand that. But the biggest point that she missed was that the answer had been found. It was found earlier on this week, when an unfortunate shooting began, but was stopped quickly by a school resource officer that was trained and armed and ended the threat.
Yep.
That's where we need to look at. I think, I don't know about teachers, I'm still open on that, but Pax Romana works great. If you're the biggest, baddest dude on the block, nobody's going to mess with you.
That's right. And by the way, out of all the things that this protest tomorrow is going to push out, the idea of bans and national registries and all that, the one you just outlined, which is very effective, the teacher in the school resource officer in Baltimore was at the scene where the shooting was happening within 1 minute of when the shooting began. He heard the shots, he ran in the direction of gunfire, unlike in Broward County, and he stopped the shooter. Now, that's the one thing, or one of a few things, that these students are not proposing. Now, doesn't it seem strange to you that of all the ideas they're throwing out, the ones that are the most sensible, harden the schools, perhaps arm the teachers. I'm in favor. You're still a question mark on that. That's okay. And make sure there are school resource officers. These students are not asking for that. Does it strike you as more than a coincidence that what these students are pushing is the standard liberal line that their adults are, that their parents are pushing? And to me, that just sounds like the parents are using them as mouthpieces for failed policies that America will not adopt.
Oh, absolutely. I don't believe that's a coincidence at all. I think that it's just, it's something that the teachers, obviously from the guest that you, the caller a little bit earlier, whose daughter was having problems at school, it's something that the schools are pushing. It's something that their parents are pushing.
Hey, you know what? I've got to break it off at that point. Live from the Moore Mansion in Pasco with KONA, it's the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.